insertion tights up on the tower. Right now. Move! Move!
I listen to 2ARM, 92.1 FM, in the car and at work, for great tunes and community news.
Hello, I'm Herb and welcome to Community Spotlight. Each Friday I try and bring in someone from our community or an organisation or an event and discuss their journey or what they're doing in our community. And this morning I have Steve Field from Urala. Good morning, Steve.
How you going, Herb?
I'm very well. Now, we'll go back and talk about your journey, but you have a partnership in the Fields Environmental Solutions and Biobank Seeds with Benjamin, your son, that was on last week.
Yes.
And your other youngest son, Michael.
Yes.
Who also works there. Let's go back to the start. You were born in Dubbo.
That's right. Back in 55.
55. And you went to school as a young fella in high school?
Yes. I went through to year 11, at which point school didn't seem to fit anymore.
And what was growing up in Dubbo like?
It was like everywhere, I suppose. You were never sheltered from too much. Everybody in town knew who you were. If you played up, your parents found out about it before the day was finished.
Was it a fairly rural sort of existence? Fishing in the Macquarie? And
yeah, swimming every day. All we had to do was be home before dark.
Idyllic existence for a young child back then. And then you went to New Zealand and to Christchurch.
That's right. I went over there about 75. I followed my wife over there, who wasn't my wife at the time. And we came back after a few months, got married, worked at the steelworks in Wollongong for a wee while, and then went back to New Zealand for another 5 years.
So what was sheet metal working like? What drew you to sheet metal working?
Oh, I just loved it. My dad was a builder, and wood was not something that really that I enjoyed, but I just love welding and metal and fabricating all manner of things.
So Ben told me last week that he was born in New Zealand. You've got children, Josh, Ben and Grace. Were they all born in New Zealand?
Josh was born in Wollongong. Ben was born in Christchurch. Gracie was born at Maxville, and Michael also was born in Armidale here.
Oh, very good. Now, 85, you came to Woolbrook. That's a bit of a change from New Zealand. Oh, well, I suppose still cold.
Oh, it was too. Every day in May, we turned up at the beginning of May, every day in May went minus 10.
So Congai was the property you came to as a station hand.
That's right.
Do you think that your early life out in Dubbo and growing up in the rural area of Dubbo has had anything to do with you coming back to your roots, I suppose, and working as a station hand?
Yeah, I've just loved the bush. I always have just loved the bush. And I was making a lot better money down the coast. I was building boats, but the money was nothing, but the lifestyle was just everything to us. Raise a family in that.
Well, to raise a family in that and having that existence in more remote with Woolbrook. Then you went to Urala.
Diaji, yes.
Diaji.
Moved up there in 85, 86, I suppose, and worked for Ian Sutherland at Diaji for a few years there. And Gracie started school while she was there. Then we moved across to John Williams' place, Gordon.
It's at East Lakes.
That's at East Lakes. Loved it there. They were lovely people, helped us get a start.
Gordon Williams, sort of that whole restoration bug you got from him.
I did. It was, yeah, I mean, it just gave me another look at life. I'd never considered it, but once it gets into your blood, it's hard to get out.
So around 94, you established the Field Retail Nursery.
Yeah, we eventually managed to save up some money, and with the assistance of my family and friends, we were able to build a very modest little house in Urala, and we decided to start a nursery there. We'd already been doing it out at East Lake, so the job wasn't new to us.
And mostly cottage, native species, but mostly for a home, cottage, little small blocks, I suppose.
Yeah.
But 96 or 98, we think maybe you went into farming restoration?
Yeah, it was obvious that we were going to struggle with just a very small nursery, and we decided that it was best to try our hand at a larger scale. So we went to, out at John Taylor's place, there was a big function on out there and a bit of an expo. We went there, decided on a few things, and then took that into town with us and started producing trees for farms.
So for farms, but was that around the same time that Greening New England sort of was pushing to restore those areas from dieback?
Yes, yes, very much. Greening Australia had quite a presence in the town here, and they did for a couple of years after we started, and then they just packed up and left. The tree group was left over from that, and they've continued on. They're doing that sort of work now. We've moved on to other enterprises now.
So one of those other enterprises in the beginning was, which you still do now, is mine rehab and restoration. What was it like back when you started? I think it's actually evolved over the time, but what was mine rehab like back in the beginning?
We were lucky enough to get a break. It wasn't something that we went looking for, but we got a break. A mine called up and said, we've got 20,000 trees that need to get in the ground and we've got nobody to do any work, and can you please come and help us? So because we weren't inducted onto the mines, they cut a lot of red tape. This is going back a long time now, so they cut a lot of red tape and allowed us to catch up with all of their safe work methods and all of that sort of stuff, the safety gear. And we were there for a number of years. We still go onto the mines to this day. We were fortunate enough that we were one of the first tree planting groups to get in there, because now it would cost you an arm and a leg to become compliant with mining rules.
So just correct me if I'm wrong, though, but back when you're talking about mine rehab over from maybe even 30 years ago, soil was very thin across the landscape when they rehabbed the area. Species were quite limited, and there probably wasn't good genetic diversity of the species. Would that be right?
Yeah, back in those days, the species was the right species, but we never knew where the seed came from. It was always, you know, you'd buy seed, but could have come from down south or up north, you know, different soil types, different elevations. There was that sort of stuff wasn't looked at very, very critically. The soil was thin. They used to harvest the topsoil and stockpile it, and then chocolate coat it, the mountain, when they'd finished.
Yeah, spread it as far as they could get it.
Exactly. And there was never enough there.
Leave exposed rock areas, which didn't really grow seed very well.
No, but one of the things that one of the mines out there had a lot of opportunity. They weren't covered in weeds, so they could strip the topsoil and store it. And when they put it back out, what they got, we found within about 18 months, we had another 40 species there, native species, that we didn't plant. A lot of daisies and hardened birches, just all manner of plants that we had nothing to do with, that just came in the topsoil that had been collected. So topsoil management became a real thing as well, you know. And it was pretty hard with some of those mines. It was only ever covered in fleabane and weeds anyway. So as soon as they chocolate-coated the mountain, that's all you got.
They would have had to restore back to rural land, would they not? Or would it been, if it was forested land, it'd be forest? Look, what do they return it back to?
Well, it comes under two categories. You've got the mine lease is where they're actually digging the coal out of the ground, and that is expected to last 30 years for them to cover that. And it's usually somewhere around 2,000 hectares. And then after a number of years ago, they decided, well, that's not good, because they could never put it back to what it was, because now you actually make dirt as you dig a hole. So now where there was flat, now it's a mountain. And so it's pretty unrealistic to get it back to where it was. Then the government decided that they should have biodiversity offsets. So they had to go and buy huge tracts of land that were not farming, that were like for like, pretty much. You weren't allowed to take out good farming country, though. So, and that had to be put back into the particular plant community types that existed. And that's where their obligation is now, to restore that purchased land that's been, you know, denigrated.
So that's separate, purchased land separate from, restore the land that was separate from the mining lease.
That's correct.
Back to what the area of the mining lease was.
Yeah, and I think it's a matter of seven times.
Seven times the value. So what do they do when they restore, as you said, chocolate coat the mountain and put the trees back in the mining lease? What do they do with it then? Is it just sold off as farming land?
Well, they're handing back some of that country now. And it'll go back to the government. I really don't. It's very, very few of those get handed back as a natural landscape. Some places up in Queensland, they've turned them into parks. They've done any amount of work. The arrangement with the government when they first start mining is that they will do something positive with it, and they do have to state what they're going to do with it, but it's not going to go back as a national park or anything.
Gotcha. So let's lead us to a little visit you made in, we think, 2013 maybe, to Murray Seed Bank in Deniliquin.
Yeah.
Tell me about that visit.
We were invited down there by Martin Driver, who's an incredible man. He's been working down there for many, many years, driving, no pun intended, but driving that seed bank for direct seeding. It has a pretty good outcome down there with winter rainfalls, and it's a bit more difficult up this way. But that was community owned. It was originally Greening Australia. I could get this wrong, but everybody's owned it. Greening Australia, and then Landcare, and then the LLSs own it as of now. Although they are closing the seed bank as of 2 weeks ago.
Why are they closing?
I think that government bodies are not allowed to engage in commercial work.
Gotcha. Well, that leads us nicely to the Fields Environmental Solutions, which is one part of a partnership organisation, Biobank Seeds. And I had Benjamin in, as I said right at the beginning, your eldest son.
Second
son, who's the principal of both those organisations. You're a partner there, and Michael, your youngest, works there. So Fields Environmental Solutions, it's a commercial arm that collects the seed or does the planting?
Right now, I would have to say that Fields Environmental Solutions is a little bit more like a labour hire, where we go out and actually do works where it's needed, like site preparations and such things. We've sort of backed off.
Management plans? Do you do the management plans as well?
Yes, we're sort of much more into assisting people to get what they want. You have to understand what they want, and they have to be able to tell you what they want, because the two just don't go together all that well.
So Fields Environmental Solutions, Ben's in Gunnedah, you're in Yarralla.
Yeah.
But obviously he visits quite regularly. You're probably on the phone a lot.
Yes.
Now, Biobank Seeds, the other arm of this organisation that we're talking about, is the collection of the seed.
That's
and
right.
The storage of the seed. We talked about the genetic diversity with Ben, and you mentioned it there with the mine rehabs. Important to have genetic diversity, or know where your genetics come from and document it. That seed then goes to Narromine Transplants to be grown for the project, then for you to get your labour out and plant it. Is that right?
Close. We sell seed as bulk seed for direct seeding. Quite a few of the mines are starting to change over to direct seeding. It's much cheaper. Some goes out to Narromine, where David Cliff grows them on, and then they get planted back into the mines. We don't do the planting anymore. It fills our time up just collecting seeds and testing them. So our seed is basically given a birth certificate when it's collected. And so it gets cleaned down. It has a unique number that gets entered into a database, and all the information about that seed, where it came from, everything is on that database. Then it gets tested for purity, viability and germinability in controlled cabinets. That data is then added to that certificate. And this birth certificate is available to the client who's purchasing it, to assure whoever the authorities are that this seed is legitimate, that it has a value, it has been tested, it is a real thing, because this industry has no standards at the moment.
Well, I think we'll talk about that in a second. Just one point. I think you mentioned that Narromine Transplant can grow out 13 million trees per year. Is that right?
Yeah, they haven't. I doubt whether they've done that since all of the harvestable wood down in Tassie and Victoria and what have you, that sort of shut down. So they haven't, I doubt whether they've been doing that, but they are getting more and more numbers in now, at a guess. I was talking to David a couple of weeks ago, and probably up to 2 or 3 million a year now.
So I suppose then, if we get into this problem with, and the reason for the forum, but all these government projects, the RES, renewable energy projects, the wind farming projects, corridors for all these developments to go in, add that to the mining rehab that's going on, add that to the conservation agreements that are going on with farmers. There is a real demand, or there'll be actually increasing demand again, so it's a bit like it's a boom and bust, I suppose, that I spoke with Ben. Not only the climate that is a little bit boom and bust, the availability of seeds boom and bust, but all these projects come online, you've got this great big boom of projects, but being able to supply the seed and the plants to be able to achieve what government is wanting to do is going to be the difficult thing.
I would imagine it's impossible just at the moment. Like I say, we sell out every year. I received a phone call a matter of just a couple of weeks ago from Central Queensland, and this chap was working for a mine of some sort, and he wanted four ton of grass seed, you know. And it's like, well, to start with, our grass is different to the grass that you'd have up there. You need to be looking locally, and you should have been looking 2 years ago. And he's sort of saying, well, we've only just got this directive that we have to do something about it immediately. And I'm like, well, sorry, but it doesn't exist.
Your stress is not my stress.
Yeah, well.
So the reason for the forum is because this is the forum we had a couple of weeks ago that was organised in Urella, the Native Plant Seed Forum, was about this particular issue. Now, you mentioned that it's an unregulated system at the moment.
Yeah.
You've got people that are collecting. You're trying to keep an eye on the genetics of it all, but you're also wanting people to comply with the flora policies about how to collect. But then you tell me that nobody's licensed and it's an unregulated system. Seems to me a big problem with how do you get to where the government wants to go with a system like that.
We've got all the licences we can get, but I don't know how legitimate they are. That's the problem. If it was to be tested, I don't even think there's enough there to test, to be honest with you. It's everybody claims to have some sort of licensing thing that you have to go and ask them for, and we've done all of that, but at the end of the day, it's nobody knows.
Well, Ben was telling me that you don't actually need to have a license to be a collector, and he would like everybody to be able to have done the training and be approved in that flora collection process.
Yeah.
But the training's not even available to people when they want to do it.
No, and that's where myself and Dave, who you'll have on next week.
That's Dave Carr.
Dave Carr, yeah. We've been rolling this out for the last few years. I think we're the only dinosaurs that are doing it now, although we haven't run any of those courses probably in 18 months.
Well, they require funding to be able to put them on. So it's a big thing to be able to contact a whole range of people to come in, do the training. I suppose some of it can be done online, but there'll be a lot of it that can't be done online.
These courses sell out, and oftentimes we have to run a second course. And they go from anywhere from a single day. We tailor it to the clients, but they go from anywhere from a single day out to 4 days. They cover a lot of countries, scientific, legal, occupational, work health and safety is involved in it as well.
So that's just the training, but because there's no person overseeing the regulation of seed collection and seed storage and all that type of stuff, there's a major problem in being able to legitimise the activities, I suppose, that you are going to do for the government projects that are coming up.
Yeah. Well, that's the goal of the forum that we were looking at. It was to highlight those shortcomings. And licensing is a big one. Getting the genetics right is another part of it. And we're sort of hoping now that we can form some sort of a governing body to install a peak body in the end. It might take a few years, I don't know, but that would be the goal, so that we can have some starch in this. And at the moment, it's only involving people that around seed, whether it's through nurseries or direct seeding or contract seeders, and they've all been invited to be a part of what we're doing.
Do you think you need a government body to be the champion for what you're trying to do?
Oh, the government's done nothing in decades, three
well,
decades.
Well, yeah, I understand that, but now you're actually trying to push this issue. Like, you almost need a government champion, whether that's LLS or one of the other government bodies.
Well, we are talking to a couple of groups that I think that could be instrumental in that, and they'll be part of it, but I'm not sure about government bodies. They lack of interest, really.
Well, I think also it's the government policies of the day that the government departments have to adhere to. And if the government policy isn't about collecting seeds and supporting the seed collectors and growers and conservation people, well, it's you might as well hold back the tide, Steve.
Yeah. Look, they've got great ideas, and this is where it falls over. The government at the moment has these great ideas, grandiose even, that they're going to do so much work out in the west, because all the work gets done on the coast. Where all the work needs to be done is in the west. So they're talking about, you know, hundreds of thousands of hectares of work to be done, but they don't tell us that we need seed for that. So we're sort of kept in the dark, and people ring us up and say, well, you know, we're looking for 4 tonne of seed. It's like,
well, that perfect example of the guy up in Queensland, yeah, with the grass seed. You'll get more phone calls like that.
Yeah, I don't know what to say to him.
Yeah. Well, look, Steve, I think we've probably got to the point where it'll be great to get Dave Carr to come in and pull apart some of those logistics and government policy type things.
Okay.
Thank you for all your efforts you've done with conservation and collecting seeds and genetics and pushing this issue. I wish you all the great things, you know, all the positive things for what you do, and thank you for coming into Community Spotlight.
Thanks very much for having me, Herb.
Broadcast, then podcast. If you missed it or want to hear it again, then visit our webpage, 2arm.net.au/podcast. I listen to 2ARM, 92.1 FM, in the car and at work, for great tunes and community news.